So this evening we come to another of the big themes, wisdom. And as I was just sitting here, I was reflecting, it's a bit quite find the right word, paradoxical, ironic, talking about wisdom, because because it's ultimately it's nothing you can talk about, something you have to realize for yourself. And maybe it's a good opportunity to remind ourselves that really all the teachings, ideally they aren't telling us what to believe, but they're just themes for meditative reflection. Perhaps sometimes hearing about different themes or different aspects or different angles on a certain topic, it may bring up some reflective capacity in our own minds, may give us something to contemplate, may give us another way of looking at things, may trigger off some wisdom, if you like, or some at least some investigation that could lead to a wisdom. There is, of course, in the in certain teachings, there is a certain element of, say, information. And I remember when I was at, you know, studying at university, and the main kind of purpose, I guess, was to learn information, get some knowledge, and possibly some understanding. But I can't remember ever hearing the word wisdom mentioned. It was something I had to go to the library and look up under the religious section about wisdom. Translation: wisdom is a translation of the Pali word panya, which is used in quite a few different contexts in the scriptures. It seems that it, like many words, it has different meanings in different contexts. The basic level, if you like, is that there's three kinds of panya, wisdom, that's mentioned in the scriptures. The first one is just thinking. Maybe most of us get our what we think is wisdom out of thinking about things. This is not the meditative reflection, as emphasized in the meditation practice, but this is just our own thinking process. If I go here, I do this, and I get this, and I get that, and as probably most of us can appreciate, thinking is usually a bit of a closed loop. We can only think about, you know, something which is within our frame of reference, or our memory, or our associations, or our field of learning. And at a kind of more basic level, thinking is still motivated by the self. It's an activity of the self. So I think about things which will please myself, or which I allow myself to think about, or which I agree with, or something. So quite limited, in other words. But it does give some kind of understanding or wisdom, if you like. Just to go back to that word panya, but quite limited. The second kind of wisdom is that which comes from learning about something. And the word which is used for learning is literally means listening, because in the Buddhist time the only way to learn was to listen to other people. And all the teachings were given verbally. There weren't any books around. And the learning is a little bit more, maybe a bit more extensive, because you hear different people's points of view, you hear different angles on things. It can complement, or it can expand, it can increase, it can broaden, widen our thinking, our field of thinking anyway. If we learn about different things, broaden our horizons. And there's, of course, then there's a whole variety of different things we can learn, you know. I mean, this is all within the context of spiritual practice, so it's assumed that what we're learning about is spiritual practices. There's in the scriptures they also mentioned about, you know, various things which aren't very helpful to learn about. You know, learning all kinds of kind of mundane or superstitious or kind of things which are not very supportive of spiritual practice, and can even be a distraction, and at the worst can even be somewhat dangerous. You know, learning about spells and omens, and all kinds of black magic or something, maybe. It could even be dangerous to learn about that kind of stuff. Especially in the wrong hands, yeah. The wrong minds, I mean. And the highest kind of wisdom, of course, is that from meditation, or literally mental development, bhavana. And the this brings in, you know, a whole different field of the understanding of wisdom then, because it's not just about, you know, intellectual part of the mind, just getting information or knowledge, but through the development, mental development of concentration, for example, of awareness, mindfulness, these are also supports in the mental development, which can give rise to wisdom, developing more awareness. And some people might say, well, what's that got to do with wisdom? You know, what do I know about? But again, if this awareness is within the right field, the right area, as in the foundations of mindfulness, for being more aware of the bodily sensations, the states of mind, you get to know about yourself then. If I'm using this mental development to become more aware of, you know, the different sounds of birds in the forest, well, it's useful, but I don't know if you call it wisdom or not. I guess you call it bird wisdom. You get wise about birds, you know. Or when I came here, I had to get wise about the different New Zealand plants, you see. And so I'm plant wise, somewhat. I don't know. I mean, I would say plant knowledgeable. Maybe I shouldn't get too inflated about it, but I can tell. I can tell a lancewood from a manuka or something. Is that wisdom? But if we apply awareness to bodily sensations and states of mind, for example, this can lead to wisdom. And then the kind of further extension of that is that in spiritual practice, this wisdom is inclining towards, or the whole purpose is to move towards liberation. Freedom from suffering, liberation, the understanding of the path of liberation. And this only can be realized through the development of more awareness, more concentration, more investigation, energy, and maybe you can say the whole development of these 10 paramitas, these 10 qualities which lead to Buddhahood, or at least a significant number of them anyway. You know, some people might think that, oh well, if I study lots, if I learn lots about all the different, you know, aspects of Buddhism, then that's the way to enlightenment. And it's not just about learning. And the mental development part, if that isn't developed or isn't increased and isn't emphasized, then you can have lots of information and knowledge. You can get your PhD in Buddhism, but maybe not be that much closer to enlightenment, actually, or liberation. So the Buddha gives this emphasis then, mental development, or meditation, as we say, is also a very important part, maybe the most important part. This is the part, actually, that I got interested in Buddhism about. I could stay in Canada and read about Buddhism, but there's no teacher there to teach meditation. And then when I studied about Buddhism, it kept mentioning meditation, meditation, meditation. So as the more I learned about Buddhism, to talk about meditation, but there wasn't any meditation teacher there. So I had to go find one in Asia. And this banya, I mentioned, is mentioned in different contexts too, in the Buddhist scriptures. Probably the most comprehensive one is this mentioned in relationship to the Eightfold Path. It's sometimes referred to as one of the three trainings, Sikha, which I mentioned in the talk about morality, I think it was. There's the three trainings in morality, meditation, and wisdom. There's the Eightfold Path, eight factors, and they're broken up into groups into a threefold category. Two of them are wisdom, three are morality, three are meditation. And in the Eightfold Path, the wisdom part comes first, actually. Right view, or right understanding, and right thought, or right aspiration, comes first. But when it's referred to in the trainings, it's usually morality, meditation, wisdom. Perhaps emphasizing the importance of wisdom coming out of mental, after meditation, see? Wisdom coming out of the meditation practice, so mental development then. However, if you look at the Eightfold Path, the first factor is right view. And this is, I guess, practically speaking, we should say this is kind of mundane right view. I mean, one needs to have a certain view or understanding. For example, the most basic one is to have an understanding of cause and effect. If one doesn't believe in cause and effect anyway, doesn't actually believe it, then why does one even start spiritual practice? If you don't believe that doing something like spiritual practice will give some effect, some positive effect, then we wouldn't even start. So one needs at least a preliminary belief or understanding or appreciation of the principle of cause and effect to get started on the Eightfold Path. So that's one of the, you know, one of the kind of foundations of the Eightfold Path, right view, is to at least believe in the principle, or at least the effectiveness of cause and effect. You can do something and get some results. You can do some spiritual practice and you'll get some benefits out of it. We aren't just stretching our knees, or we aren't just we aren't just spending a quiet Sunday afternoon, but you're actually getting some result in some way. Right view, of course, is, and sometimes it's mentioned in the scriptures, being very fundamental. It's like having the right direction to go in, I guess you'd say. If you're gonna travel on a path, for example, give that analogy, on a path, and you haven't got the right direction, it doesn't matter how far you walk and how much effort you put into it, you're not going to get to the goal. You're not going to get in the right get to the goal if you haven't started off with the right direction. Maybe you have fun along the way. You get some exercise and you get some strength and you learn a few things, but you don't get to the goal if you haven't got the right direction to go in. So sometimes the Buddha emphasizes in the scriptures right view is very fundamental. And I should add maybe that also fundamental to right view is not holding on to it, not having a fixed view. It's not only having a wrong view, but it's also not having a fixed view. I prefer to use the word right vision or right viewing, because we have a bit more dynamic. It's on an ongoing process, because just like, you know, if you're going from here to Upper Hutt, okay, you know the direction to go in, but as you go there, your view changes, doesn't it? First of all, you're going that way. Okay? You think, well, Upper Hutt is that way. Why am I going that way? Because that's the way the road goes. If you want the rough way, you can go that way. Over the mountains, you know. But you go this way first, and then you change your view. Yeah? Your view evolves. And then you realize, oh, now I got to go that way. When I get down to the river, I can't cross the river, so I got to go that way. So your view is actually changing as you go along. And first of all, you're seeing it, you know, seeing the direction from a long distance away, and as you get closer, you see more details, and you have to be able to recognize the changing panorama. Mm-hmm. So if one has a fixed view, one keeps going that way, and you'll splash into the river and don't arrive in Upper Hutt. You get down the river and end up in Lower Hutt. You wash down the river out to sea, Nip and Wellington maybe, or South Island even. But right view is mentioned in many different contexts, and one of the most comprehensive one is in the what's called the middle length sayings. And there's a whole list of different things that comprise right view, or can be aspects of right view. Like I said, the there's basic is believing, or at least having some openness to cause and effect. And then it's related to specific Buddhist teachings, for example, the Four Noble Truths, believing in or having some understanding of the Four Noble Truths, that there is unsatisfactoriness, there's a cause, there's a cessation of it, and then there's a path for the cessation of suffering, which is a causal view, isn't it? You know, there's something there, there's a cause of it. If we remove the cause, then it'll cease. And there is a way, there is actually a method. The Eightfold Path of Spiritual Practice will help us to remove the cause of suffering. So, however, you know, your view or your understanding is that's a theory, that's a principle, but now to realize it, to actually do it, and find out for ourselves if it really works. Then they go through a whole list of different aspects of the Buddhist teachings. One of them is understanding of what is skillful and unskillful. And basically, this is what Ajahn Chah defined wisdom as, knowing what is skillful, unskillful, what is beneficial, not beneficial. And in a general sense, we can learn about that from the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha tells us, as we already heard about, say, for example, about morality, you know, keeping the five precepts is wholesome, is beneficial. Yeah, but to be able to apply that to our own particular life situation, when we actually see the benefits, then it becomes our own wisdom then. Previously, maybe it's the Buddha's wisdom. The Buddha says, keep the five precepts and you get some benefit. And you say, well, I don't know about this. Looks pretty tough to me. And then maybe you try and practice the five precepts and it's not so beneficial. It's hard work. You know? But then maybe later, if you keep up with it, you begin to see, oh yes, my mind is free of remorse. My mind is free of confusion and doubt and worry and fear because of I have a good foundation in skillful living then. When I sit down and meditate, my mind isn't full of all these confusion and doubts about things. Because I can go back to, oh, I led a very good life. And you see for yourself. And you know, oh, right. It's not just the Buddha's wisdom, I see it myself now. I realize it for myself. Now wisdom's beginning to grow within us then, our own wisdom. Then there is a few other aspects of the Buddha's teachings that is mentioned part of right view, but they're a little bit technical. The four nutriments, the 12 links of dependent origination. Maybe that'll have to be next year's talks, maybe. Or something a little bit more practical. Having some understanding of the principle of aging and dying is also under the category of right view. Knowing that, hey, we're not ultimately permanent, we're going to age and die eventually. So this can perhaps give us some more commitment or faith or energy, perhaps, which is the energy is the next topic, I think. And then there is the kind of what's called maybe the mundane right view, which is about believing in cause and effect and the benefit of spiritual practice and the benefit of good things. Then there's what they call super mundane right view. This is where the right view now becomes part of the meditation practices. It's now conjoined with the path. Practically speaking, I would say that you begin to see the results of our meditation. When you actually see results from development of concentration and awareness, then we're starting to not only believing in cause and effect, but you're getting to see the results and seeing that, oh, the Eightfold Path is beginning to work. Some foundation of skillful living and development, a bit more concentration or awareness exercises, you begin to see, oh, sort of coming together now. And there is a little bit more insight or understanding with regard to the way the mind is working, the way the body is, whole nature of grasping and letting go, for example. And then, of course, this wisdom part is also not only right view or right viewing or right vision, right understanding, it's also right thought. And last week I mentioned one of the factors of right thought, relinquishment or renunciation, letting go. And this is one of the factors of right thought or right, I would say right aspiration. It's like having the right intention behind. You know, if you're going to get to your goal, for example, you need to have the right direction to go in, but you also need the right attitude. You know, if you're really, really compulsive about it, like, I've got to get to the end, I've got to get to the upper hut, I've got to get there. You're really compulsive about it. Probably you might, and I've got to get there right now. You could have an accident, or you could be so, that compulsion can keep your mind so narrow, you wouldn't recognize the changing panorama, the changing view as you go along. So fundamental to spiritual practice is harmlessness, freedom from cruelty, and renunciation. The whole principle of letting go, giving up of the ego. And this is, as I mentioned last Sunday, you know, very fundamental to spiritual practice, because many of us bring our, you know, our ego-based, goal-orientated attitudes. You know, I'm practicing for me. Yeah, well, I am practicing for me. You know, kind of relatively speaking, until you find out there's no me to practice for. You know? That may take a little bit of insight, maybe. It's like you're collecting, we're collecting things spiritually for ourselves, and then you realize, hey, there's nobody there in the first place. Nobody can own all this. It's just processes that we've been accumulating. See? So right view has, I mean, right wisdom has right view and right thought, or right aspiration, right intention, as well as the viewing. You have to bring these two together. An attitude, skillful attitude, as well as the right understanding or knowledge or information too. How to use that knowledge or understanding then in a skillful way. Rather than always taking it to yourself, we have to have the attitude of letting it go, renunciation. Sometimes the word banya is used in the scriptures with a prefix to it. I can think emphasizing its kind of super mundane or its development in an ultimate sense. That there is some kind of knowing or wisdom, but is also kind of super wisdom. So it's defined, it's got a prefix of adipanya, which means kind of higher wisdom, and even aryapanya, the noble wisdom. It could be the wisdom of the nobles, or it could be the wisdom of the noble eightfold path or something. And so finally, you can say in its kind of further development anyway, it is actually approaches what we call vipassana meditation. You know, there's the understanding, the thinking and the learning part of it, but there's a direct knowing, the direct seeing then. Vipassana literally means to see directly or clearly. Pasana means seeing, and there's a V, which is an emphasis. So we see very clearly, ultimately. And this, you know, kind of paradoxically, I think most of us usually refer to wisdom. I would refer to wisdom kind of up here somewhere, up in the brain, you know. It's like knowing somehow in the brain. But then vipassana, we really see clearly, one needs to be able to quiet down the mental activity, quiet down the brain activity, to be able to open to the reality as it really is, without all the interpretations, without all the analysis and the judgments about it. So in one way, in an initial way, you know, to have a right view, we study about it, study right, what is right view, we got to, you know, what are the Four Noble Truths, what are the Four Nutriments, dependent origination, what are these factors? But then, you know, these are just themes to kind of bring up into our consciousness, and then to quieten the mind down, quieten the intellectual or the judging or analyzing faculty, and allow these qualities to come clear to us, you know, to see them beyond the thinking about them. And this is where then concentration comes in. The mind is more concentrated, the mental activity is quietened down, but we're still awake, we're still clear, we're still focused. And if we've, in a way, fed in a certain theme, like the Four Noble Truths, in a way, this is where the concentration now begins to get focused within that area of our life, you know, suffering and the cause of it. It doesn't mean that we focus on suffering, but you focus on the investigation of it until you can actually begin to experience it more directly. Especially something, I would say, like suffering, because I don't know how your experiences are, but I mean mine is that when there's suffering, this is when the mind speeds up, trying to figure a way out of it. You know? But if I can go into, you know, recognize, go to the breathing, maybe recognize a bit more calm, it allows me to go to that suffering, what seems to be the suffering, and begin to look at it more clearly. And many times the suffering is more in the interpretation of it, or all the stories that are spun around it, the memories and associations that are spun around it, than the suffering itself. It's just fear. You know, can you just look at the fear? I mean, not so easy. Maybe it's a bit too early tonight, or too late, maybe. You know, but most of the time, I mean, my experience is if my mind is not very calm, something like fear comes up, and then I'm spun off into all the stories about it, and the memories, and how it was before, and it gets 10 times as big. If the mind is somewhat calm, I can look at the fear. It's just fear. Just fear. I don't want to say just in the sense of that it's not it's insignificant, but more in the sense of it's just that is that experience, and not all the story about it. Just to be able to focus on or recognize or give some boundary to that experience, physically, mentally, emotionally, as an emotion right there, fear. And not get caught in all the stories about it, and all the resistance, and all the memories about it. It's quite different then, just fear. And sometimes, it's maybe to me, I just say it to myself, oh, it's just fear, it's not the stories. The stories are more frightening than the fear, actually. Stories that are built around it, or have built around it, are more frightening than the fear. It also, when you can do that, you isolate this emotion from the baggage that's holding it in place. And fear is just a rising and passing phenomena. Comes and it goes. If you when it comes up and you get stuck in the story about it, suddenly it gets the concrete. It gets fixed in concrete now, or stone, because all the stories, they do have an extra weight to them. But if you look at it just as a sensation in the body or a certain state, mood of mind, then it's much more flexible. It's come and it's gone. Anyway, this is where the emphasis on the mental development is a very significant or important part of real wisdom then. And then vipassana practice in its kind of basic phase, vipassana is a kind of an investigation, kind of a contemplation. We're contemplating, we're looking at, we're giving direction to our awareness, to be aware of the sensations in the body, the feeling tones, the states of mind. So we need to be somewhat knowledgeable of what they are, and then direct the mind in that way, in that area of our experience, to be able to see it more directly. So there's some learning part to it, but then the real vipassana, with a capital V, is that direct insight. And not only does it starts off with being aware of, say, these particular areas of our experience, say, sensation, for example, physical sensations, but as we begin to go into it in a more deeper or more direct or more concentrated and aware way, we begin to see not just sensations themselves, we begin to see the fundamental principles behind it. You know, for example, what are the insights of vipassana is impermanence, looking at sensations. And if we stay at the level of my sensations, it can seem pretty solid, pretty permanent. But if the awareness begins to develop a certain power in itself, begins to see beyond the limitations of sensation, my particular sensations, to the principle, the fundamental principles behind it, kind of the universal truths behind it, just impermanent. They're all changing processes. And sometimes people can have these insights quite intuitively, maybe even without a lot of pre-knowledge or information beforehand. Other people, maybe it's helpful that they actually contemplate or reflect in that direction. You know, one of the themes for contemplation is arising and passing away, arising and passing away. It's what they call one of the vipassana knowledges. You actually give particular attention to the arising and passing away nature. And maybe in the beginning it's a little bit artificial. You know, but if we're setting up the mind to be aware of that, arising, passing away, impermanence, transience is already here. We train the mind to look the other way. We tend to train the mind to look at permanence. That's what the nature of self is. The self wants to see permanence. You know, so I persist because it doesn't, ultimately. So it has to. It doesn't want to see that, you know. It doesn't want to let you know that you're impermanent. You know, it keeps looking for permanence all the time. So it's already, the self biases our vision, our view of things. And now giving some special emphasis to seeing impermanence just brings it into focus now. It's like it's there already, we just haven't focused on it, that's all. We're focusing on permanence now. And sometimes it can help that this, you know, by giving it a bit more attention, it comes into focus and, oh yes, how did I miss it? So vipassana ultimately can lead to the ultimate wisdom. The ultimate wisdom is being able to realize at the deepest level impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. And something like non-self, as Ajahn Chah said, if you think about it, your head will explode. If you're just thinking about it, thinking me, thinking about myself, then you'll blow a fuse maybe. But if you observe the nature of me, sensations and thought, observe it, begin to see, hey, I didn't think this thought, you know, especially if it's stupid thought, I didn't think that thought. You know, this thought just thought me. This thought thought me, yeah. This thought happened and I thought it was me. I couldn't find somebody else to blame, that's why. But when you begin to see more directly, then this wisdom becomes a direct awareness, direct seeing, then. A different kind of wisdom. We're seeing the true nature of things, and sometimes that's where the words cease, actually. That's where it's hard to talk about it anymore, because it has to be our own experience, and it's a direct experience happening in the present moment, and the words are usually an interpretation afterwards. This is called in the Pali language, this is called the knowledge and vision of things as they are. And interesting that it's a knowledge and vision, jnana dasana. The jnana is the knowledge part and dasana is the seeing part or vision of it. Because it is a kind of knowledge then, a jnana. Just like the wisdom or consciousness. It is a knowing quality to it. But because it's based upon direct seeing, it's a different dimension to it, a different quality to it. It's hard to write your thesis about it sometimes, you know. But each one of us is able to recognize that for ourselves. And when people have a direct insight, they know. And somebody might say, well, how do you know? Good question. I just know. It's just that knowing. It's very spontaneous and very personal. But it does manifest, of course, in people's mode of being then. Somebody who is realized. It's not a matter of just, you know, having it as a memory or knowing about it and going back to their old self. If they really have a direct insight, it's a transformation, transforming insight. Transforms their view of the world, their way of being in the world. And when I met some monks in Thailand, for example, and there's some teachers there, they give these Vipassana courses, you see. 10 days of meditation, of Vipassana meditation. And at the end of it, you know, because they're kind of well-known teachers, it's very kind of important that people pass the course, you see. If you do a 10-day course, you should get enlightened at the end of it, see. So they give out certificates, enlightenment certificates at the end of it. See? Well, those who get enlightened anyway. You can get your Sotapanna certificate, see. You're certified as a stream enterer, at least by this teacher anyway. Maybe some other teacher might refute it. Because he's a different technique, see, and his is better than the other one. But I met one of these monks who had been certified as a stream enterer. See, I met one. Of course, he himself said he didn't believe it. I didn't believe it either. But some of them I met, they were, to me, they were very conceited, actually. I'm a Sotapanna, you know. You should bow down to me because I am an stream enterer. I'm enlightened. I think, well, if you're enlightened, why is the ego so big there? You know, characteristics of a stream enterer is they've seen through the ego. See, they've had the first glimpse of emptiness, of selflessness, of non-self. See, so you'd think that would kind of humble the ego, you know. But I guess maybe afterwards, you know, the ego comes back. It's not completely gone, see. You haven't seen completely through the ego and stream entry. Only the arahant has seen through it completely. So maybe you just see it through it 5% and then it comes back again to hold on to or affirm that identity as a stream enterer, see. Anyways, strange things can happen. And another one of the ways in which wisdom is mentioned in a more practical sense, it's one of the five powers, spiritual powers, faculties and powers. And this is helpful to reflect upon it, because sometimes, you know, wisdom is kind of held up to be the ultimate realization. I mean, one way Ajahn Chah explained the Eightfold Path, for example, in this threefold category, you know, morality, meditation, and wisdom, he says, okay, it's not a matter of just a one-way street, you see. You do your develop morality and then do meditation, get wisdom, get enlightened, and then it's all over. He said, no, it feeds back again. And when somebody has some degree of wisdom, some insight, this reinforces their way of behaving, see. A way of living in the world or behaving. Their behavior. And they refine it, if you like. Their behavior is refined. It gives more basis for meditation, for concentration. It can give deeper insight then, deeper wisdom. So it's a continuous process. It's like a loop. The Eightfold Path is like a loop trail, see? Like the one around the monastery here. You keep coming back again to the stupa. It's not just a one-way trip, and then I get there and I'm enlightened, and I can forget about it. It's kind of, it's a feedback loop, maybe, you know. Because sometimes people think, oh, wisdom is the ultimate, you know, I just got to keep fighting and striving for and aspiring towards wisdom, wisdom, wisdom. But if your life doesn't change, whoops, something's wrong. Like some people, they can maybe have an experience of awakening, I would even say, but if it doesn't feed back into their life again, and their life doesn't change, something's not right there. You know, you can have an insight, unless it's really grounded in your being and how you live your life and relate to the world. I wouldn't say it's really been transformative, a transformative insight. It hasn't really been integrated into your life then. So it's just a memory. Yeah, so you can mistake it. Oh, I've got wisdom now. And then I've got wisdom. Then it just increases your ego again. So in the teaching about the five powers, though, there's five of these powers. Mindfulness is the middle, and then wisdom is balanced with faith. It's a balancing. You need to balance wisdom with faith. Not only wisdom itself, but you need the faith element as well. And how I see this is that the faith element is an openness to the unknown. Because even you have some wisdom, even there is some wisdom, there's lots we don't know about. You need a certain amount of faith, or you can say trust. Trust, or when it becomes a little bit more well-established, it's a bit more like confidence. But there is the knowing part, and then there is another aspect to it. There's some things I don't know, or I can't know, that are still mysterious. And it's not a matter of, just by that I've got all the knowing. Because I've had one insight, I know everything. You know, there's some, in some of the descriptions of the Buddha, for example. In the early scriptures, the Buddha never claimed to be omniscient. But later, when the life of the Buddha became a little bit more complicated and a little bit more jazzed up, they talk about the Buddha being omniscient, knowing everything. In one of the scriptures, in the Theravada anyway, somebody says to the Buddha, oh, you're all-knowing. The Buddha says, no, no, no. I just know when a thought arises and when a thought ceases. That's all you have to know. Sometimes we think, oh, wisdom is knowing everything. Ooh, watch out. It can be very self-deluding. And maybe we distract ourselves by trying to learn about all kinds of things which are not really useful. I mean, in another of the scriptures, the Buddha was walking near a forest. And then he turned to the monks and he said, which do you think is more, the leaves in the forest or the leaves in my hand? He said, well, that's an easy one. The leaves in the forest are much more than the leaves in your hand. He said, that's what I know is equal to the leaves in the forest. That's how much I know. Very likely from all of his deep meditations and meditations that were not about Buddhism or the spiritual path even, the path the Buddha discovered. Because he did all kinds of spiritual practices before discovering the path to awakening. But he said, the leaves in my hand, even though they're fewer, this is all you need to know. This is enough. You don't have to know everything. Just have to know, like this handful of leaves is like the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That's all you have to know. So, I mean, knowing about how this body and mind works, for example. We don't have to study anatomy and physiology just to be able to know what is your subjective experience. And if you give attention to that, that's enough to give you awareness, vipassana, insight into impermanence. You don't have to study the whole anatomy of the body, just noticing your own physical sensations arising and passing away. And when you see that arising and passing away, you can have the insight, the true insight, the ultimate wisdom then, into the true nature of things. No matter whether it's through the bodily sensations or through the feeling tones or the states of mind, and it doesn't matter which of these areas of our experience, but when we realize impermanence in its ultimate sense, unsatisfactoriness, non-self, then we've arrived at the ultimate wisdom. And somebody can, some of the forest masters, for example, meditation masters in Thailand, some of them were virtually illiterate. They couldn't read or write, but they were enlightened. Doesn't mean you have to go backwards, but but pointing out what is real wisdom, what is true wisdom. See? If you know your own mind, then you're really wise, but you know, in our worldly sense, we just think, well, a person who can write their, you know, write the best essay is wise or something. But this is distracting us from what is the real essential wisdom, if you like, the true wisdom. And this is something we can only get a little taste of from the books, from the scriptures. They can give us the plan, as it were, the direction, but we have to go there ourselves. So some of the chanting we do, like the chanting tonight, Pachatang ve ti tabo vinyuhi ti, it means to be realized each person for themselves. You know, and that's something we have to develop and cultivate ourselves. That's why the mental development is so important. It's not about, you know, developing a mental health hospital, developing your own mind, developing the mental qualities in your own mind. And the benefit is that once they're developed, you know, maybe I shouldn't say this, but once they're developed, they don't go away. I mean, once they developed, they're a foundation for deeper insights and deeper clarity. Maybe they do go away when your mind goes away or when you get Alzheimer's or something. Who knows? You know, it's another one of these, one of the unthinkables. Was the realm of jhana, of absorption. The Buddhist was one of the unthinkables, unknowables, because it's just so extensive or so comprehensive. I would say it's hard to know with the rational mind. When your mind is experiencing deeper levels of concentration, you can have some extra special way of knowing. But you know yourself. Yeah, that's what the really important part is. You know through awareness, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. You know, so the development of wisdom, you know, starts off in a practical sense. I mean, we tune into it or plug into it wherever we're at. Whether it's about thinking, learning, or mental development, I think most of us appreciate the value of mental development. And even though sometimes it may seem that it's a bit, you know, there's no kind of a textbook about mental development. It's quite an open field right now because not many people have had that much experience about it. But at least cultivating these areas of our life, you know, the qualities of concentration and awareness, we're getting to get familiar with it. Just beginning to know about yourself. I was telling the people in Palmerston North about a man who, a psychologist actually, he coined the phrase emotional intelligence because there was so much emphasis in the education system about intelligence quotient, IQ. Remember taking your IQ tests? Yeah, I never figured out, never told me what my IQ was, but maybe they were afraid to. There's so much emphasis on IQ, but then they found that there's no direct correlation between IQ and happiness. They study people at high IQ and they're not necessarily happy. But there's something else. So this guy began to study what was the correlation. And the direct correlation between to happiness was from emotional intelligence. People who know about themselves, knew what their moods were, what their emotions were. They were the ones, there was a direct correlation from those who know more about themselves and happiness. I mean, you could say practically, if you know what your mind is up to, you know, it's the best prevention you have, huh? Not to get caught in your mind. not to, if you know what the tricks the mind comes up with, you don't get caught by those tricks. You know? And so he was a Vipassana meditator, by the way. Doing mindfulness meditation, so he emphasized the importance of this emotional intelligence, knowing your own mind. And he even developed some exercises for schools. In the schools, they, instead of having a roll call in the morning, the children would actually say how they're feeling, a little check-in in the morning. I'm feeling happy, I'm feeling sad, or whatever. And gradually they began to not only learn to read their own mind and emotions, but they began to hear how what other people were too. You know, this is a little bit like, in a way, trying to observe your states of mind, become familiar with them more directly. You know, there's no kind of textbook around to say, okay, you've got this, you got some sadness, okay, now you got to do this with it and that with it. Unless you go to the psychiatrist, I guess. But you begin to see your moods and emotions, you begin to see where they come from and how to free yourself from them. And this is a very fundamental, you can say, exercise in self-knowing or mental development or the wisdom the Buddha is talking about, mental development. And it's a direct correlation to happiness, because applying to Buddhism, when you know about where your suffering comes from, you find the source of it. You find the source of it, then you can resolve it completely. By just distracting ourselves from it, we're never going to be free of suffering. We'll never be free of it, because we don't see where it's coming from. So wisdom starts off with a kind of practical understanding, but eventually really leads to the wisdom, the understanding of the ultimate truth, which we're all capable of realizing sometime within our life. So hopefully we have the aspiration to work in that direction and see for ourselves. Then you'll know directly. So I offer that for your reflection this evening.